line is that sanctions have had no effect whatsoever on the economy.
But it's a shame, really, because we can do virtually anything. It doesn't have to be computers. It can really be anything. We can sell hair for wigs, for instance. Artwork? Sure, we can provide. Anything they need, we can do. But it takes a certain adventurous spirit. What I mean is the person has to be either a little bit daring, to not care about the sanctions, or else working in a sector that's not affected by them, or else a person who comes from a country that's not participating in the sanctions. We need partners. So, can you help me find one?
I try to think of a diplomatic way to tell her that no one I know would be stupid or risky enough to do business with North Korea. I want to be as honest as possible without hurting her feelings.
Your country has a little bit of a PR problem, I tell her,
in what is probably the understatement of the decade. I explain that some countries will actually spend lots of money, millions of dollars, to hire a large public relations firm to help improve their country's image, to make it more attractive for investors. I know you have no control over this, but I really wish someone, somewhere, at one of the higher levels, would think about doing something like that, because it would make what you're trying to do a whole lot easier.
It's never going to happen, Min states emotionlessly.
She might not be willing or able to put it into words, but she understands implicitly a truth that citizens of a non-totalitarian state can never fathom. As Hannah Arendt wrote, "What makes a totalitarian country so unpredictable to the rest of the world is its emancipation from the profit motive, that its wasteful incompetence in the economic sphere is very much intentional, calculated so as to exert total control over its populace." To what extent all these recent indices of wealth gleaned on the streets of Pyongyang represent sincere expressions of the new regime's intent, nobody can be certain.
"Anyway, why would we do that? Pay money for foreign propaganda?" Min asks. "To me, it's not a good business practice to spend money on results you cannot see."
I sigh, studying the trail of the water down the gray-white, sun-baked crags of the mountain. "That's just how business works in the 21st century," I say. "You have to spend money in order to make money. It's all about image, marketing, PR. These PR firms hold some sway over the media. They have contacts. They can place stories to help improve the image of a place. I understand that you're business-minded, that you want to do business and be successful, but the people in power, in your government here, they're not thinking along those lines. They don't seem to care what the media says, but the media has great influence, Min. And it means that people, not just in America, but everywhere, they're afraid of this place." I make a broad, sweeping gesture with my arm, and then I realize how ridiculous it looks and sounds. I'm standing, after all, in front of one of the most beautiful sights in Asia. Probably one of the most scenic vistas in the entire world. One that so few people have seen. And calling it scary. Min nods her head, oblivious to the terrible irony of it all.
"This is why we need someone who is a little bit bold, a little bit risky. Because if they come here, if they see what Korea is really like, you know they won't be scared. They will see how it actually is here."
It seems like a fair enough pitch, but it's also naive, because nobody believes that what they are shown here is real. But I don't say this to Min. Instead, I ask what kind of business she sees herself doing. What kind of partner should I look for when I go back out into the world? Min doesn't have a clear answer. She keeps repeating, "Anything. Anything. We can do anything." "Then how does it work?" I ask. "Let's say I find a potential partner."
"I can give you our office email. You can address it to either me or to Comrade Kim. We will get it, and we will respond immediately."
"Do you not have a personal email address where I can reach you?"
"No, there is just an office email. It all goes to one person, the secretary who deals with the emails. Otherwise it would be chaos.
I have to bite my lip. It sounds like a comical excuse for the regime's restricting the vast majority of its citizens from communication with the outside world. Though in actuality, there is probably not much more than one computer in their office either. I have seen the inside of many offices by now, and almost none of them have computers. Okay, so I send an email to your office. How do I then introduce you to the foreign business partner? Are you and Comrade Kim able to travel? To come to, say, Berlin, and meet them to discuss details?
It's better they come here, to Pyongyang. That way we can show them everything we have to offer.
Translation: it's very difficult to get permission to travel abroad, especially to discuss a deal that might not result in anything. I tell her that there are other issues, that the bad press isn't just about politics or nuclear weapons, that in the business world, deals that have gone wrong here have also been reported in the media, that serious investors are loath to trust anything and anyone here because of that. So it would be a bit difficult to persuade investors to spend money to come and explore those opportunities. She asks me what I'm talking about. Well, the biggest one is probably your Coriolink network. Your mobile phones? It was an investment by Orascom, an Egyptian company. It invested a 75% stake in the company together with the government. Of course, Coriolink becomes wildly successful. You and everyone you know now has a mobile phone and uses it, right? Well, guess what happened to Orascom? Suddenly, it had a really tough time getting its profits out of the country. Its money, of course, was here, in a Korean bank. Eventually, your government seized control of the business altogether. Orascom leaves the picture empty-handed.
What was the name of this company from Egypt?
Orascom, I tell her. She makes a mental note. Clearly, she knows nothing of this. She doesn't try to make any apologies. What can she say? That's the government, not private individuals like her and Kim? She can't say that, because officially, the only business here is government business. What about discussion of the financial details? I ask her, continuing to play along. Is it safe to do that over email?
What do you mean?
I mean, say they are making a concrete offer. They want to negotiate a price. Can I include that information, those numbers, in the email?
It would be better for you if you didn't.
I see. And yet I don't. Or, I do, and I don't. The duplicitous nature of how accounting is done in the new era. There are the official books, what it might look like were the company a state-run business, and the unofficial books, which reflect the reality of the situation, the profit-making stakes of all involved.
Min,
I say, why don't you try to do business with the Chinese? There are Chinese businessmen everywhere in Pyongyang. They're so easy to meet.
I don't get the Chinese, she says.
You know, I'm a lot more Western-minded in my thinking. Probably because I grew up in Cuba. It's useless. The more I try to explain to her the potential objections of a Western investor, the more I realize that what I'm describing out loud is essentially a system of corruption. Of course, it's not Min's fault. It is a system corrupted in equal measure by the incompetent totalitarian state, by the U.S.-led sanctions that effectively criminalize economic activities regarded as mundane everywhere else in the world, and the neoliberal economics that is itself rife with inequalities, which North Koreans have no choice but to aspire to. A system whose corrupt qualities Min either tries to obfuscate or else naively admits to, apparently unaware of what is wrong with this business environment in which she is so keen to involve me. Then again, whether she's aware of it or not, I recognize it is all she really has, as the conversation reaches its inconclusive peak. The Kuryong Falls, much like the scenery of the Mount Kumgang area, is rife with legends. The name Kuryong, which means nine dragons, is a reference to the creatures said to have resided here, in this well of water at the bottom of the falls. The ancient protectors of Mount Kumgang, with all its scenic and perhaps other more valuable treasures. In modern times, a different sort of dragon emerged to protect the riches of Mount Kumgang. While Min and I were having our conversation, the guys made it to the top of Kumgang, as Alexander later relayed to me. Alexander stood next to Comrade Kim, observing one of Korea's finest landscapes. "It's spectacular, isn't it?" said Alexander. "Yes," replied Comrade Kim. "A spectacle indeed. But do you know about Kumgang Mountain? What is inside the mountain?" Alexander hesitated. "Diamonds, right? They call it Diamond Mountain." "No," Comrade Kim shook his head. "Not diamonds. Gold. The mountain we are standing on, it is full of gold."
"Hmm.
I see," said Alexander. "So then, why hasn't it been mined?" Comrade Kim shrugged his shoulders. "Before he died, Kim Il-sung said it's not meant for us. It should be kept for a future generation." Alexander nodded. He didn't say anything further, but he couldn't help but notice not just the desultory tone in Comrade Kim's voice, but that all North Koreans, when referring to any of the leaders in any language, are required to precede their names with one of their honorific sobriquets: the Great Leader Kim Il-sung, the General Kim Jong-il, the Marshal Kim Jong-un. A practice that Comrade Kim had just very pointedly neglected. Chapter 45. After our hike, we cool off at the beach. Here, there is no foreigners-only section, so we are able to freely mingle with the locals. Even the beach seems to have been specially designed to impress, with its combed white sand and placid waters. Everyone is in a happy mood, especially our Korean hosts, who frolic like children. Comrade Kim has rented or borrowed a raft from somewhere, and we take turns trying to knock each other off it into the water. Attracted by our screams and splashes and hysterical laughter, an older man comes over and joins us, clapping his hands and joining in the fun, unable to resist the opportunity to fraternize with the only foreigners in sight. Some soldiers engage us in a game of water soccer. It's a rather cruel version of the game that I will soon feel horrible for participating in, where a woman is chosen to serve as the human goal for each team, which leaves men as ours. We play in waist-high water, and if the ball hits the woman goal, then the other team scores a point. Of course, we're all lousy at it, and unable to protect Min from the opposing team's viciousness. She gets hit several times, culminating with the final score, when the soccer ball lands squarely on her nose, and she bursts into tears. The soldiers cheer their victory, while Kim swims over to comfort his comrade. Back on the shore, it seems we've crossed a demarcation line. Whereas in the water, everyone is eager to fraternize with us, as we rest in the sand, people are sure to keep their distance. Here comes the old man who was so eager to be our playmate a few minutes ago. I greet him in my elementary Korean and wave. He keeps his head down low and quickly walks past, as though he's never seen me before. Public opinion in South Korea is mixed when it comes to assessing the merits and minuses of the Sunshine Policy. Some, including many defectors who have gravitated toward the right since arriving in the South, feel that it was a self-aggrandizing move by South Korean politicians, who should have at least demanded from Kim Jong-il a demonstrable improvement in the human rights situation before handing over regime-sustaining aid of food and finances. Some say that the Kaesong Industrial Park was merely a cynical ploy for South Korean corporations to benefit from the North's cheap labor. A microcosmic foreshadowing of the exploitation that is bound to happen if and when reunification actually does occur. But in many ways, the complicating factor in the sunshine policy of two liberal South Korean presidents was the United States, which at the time was in the hands of George W. Bush's conservative government. In the South Korean political divide, those on the right tend to be pro-American and pro-military, while those on the left favor a Yankee-go-home disarmament and a peaceful resolution to the inter-Korean crisis. As to what exactly that resolution might look like, there are a few ideas, but not much consensus. For conservative South Koreans, the Sunshine Policy was an unforgivable act of defiance against the Washington status quo. Above all, they fear that if the U.S. were to pull its military presence out of the South tomorrow, the North would immediately invade and take over the entire peninsula. To make concessions to the North, then, is to weaken the South's alliance with the United States, an alliance without which right-wing South Koreans can't fathom their country's continual existence. Some conspiracy-minded right-wingers even went so far as to attribute sinister machinations to Kim and Roh's moves toward engagement. This is another old tactic of the right in South Korea, where anyone displaying the slightest liberal leaning is branded a commie, a northern sympathizer, even a secret agent. Current President Moon Jae-in, from the center-left Democratic Party, had to endure such accusations from his right-wing opponents on the campaign trail. There is the by-now routine complaint that, far from deterring the North from developing its Songun, or military-first policy, the financial benefits received from the South during the Sunshine years went directly into the nuclear weapons program. Then there is the matter of the North's continual military provocations throughout the Sunshine Policy, mainly skirmishes around disputed maritime boundaries that resulted in casualties on both ends. This is trotted out as proof that the South Koreans were being merely naive, that the North was never sincere in its desire for peaceful coexistence and eventual reunification. However, such a conclusion relies on the assumption that the military in North Korea is always under the supreme leadership's command. There is a school of thought, among Pyongyangologists, that Kim Jong-il's instigation of the Songun policy was at least in part a concession to a contingent of the upper echelons of the military that was growing restless. A military coup is not something unheard of in such unstable models of statehood, and fear of one would have been a good reason for Jong-il to add the Korean People's Army to his power base upon the death of his father in 1994. Doing so would grant the army a certain amount of authority, and with authority comes autonomy to act in certain cases. As the two Koreas remained technically at war throughout the Sunshine Policy, with no peace treaty ever signed, a wartime mentality was retained by the soldiers serving on the front line. Perhaps the Sunshine Policy was even an impetus for the fighting. Just because you throw cash at us, it doesn't mean we'll give in. Perhaps there's some truth, though, in the speculation that the North has not been sincere in its stated desire for reunification. At least not reunification of the overnight sort. Most reunification scenarios appear nightmarish to both the regime and its elites, save for the one Kim Il-sung envisioned and more or less fought for his entire life, a Korea united under his rule. If it is to be reunification by absorption, where the more economically and politically powerful country gets to do the absorbing, a la Germany, then it would only mean for the North Korean leadership, calamity, being put on trial for crimes against humanity at worst, exile at best. For the elites and Donju, being forced to compete with South Korean business concerns. And for everyone else, second-class citizenship, or worse, next to one's rich southern brethren. But the truth is, the South doesn't want an immediate reunification scenario either. Economists' estimates vary, but many believe that if the North were to collapse tomorrow, the current economic disparity, perhaps 10 times that of East and West Germany at the time of the former's collapse, is so great that it would be a burden impossible to shoulder by the affluent South. It would likely lead to a collapse of their economy, or else a strain so great on its citizens that social unrest is all but guaranteed. It would, in other words, be a collapse of the existing social order in both countries. An event that neither North nor South is prepared for. This is why it was easy, after the first of two successive conservative governments came into power in the South, to slam the door shut on the Sunshine Policy. To be fair, the left-leaning architects of the policy had no intention of overnight reunification, and they knew better than to rock the boat by dictating too many direct demands about food distribution, prison camps, and nuclear weapons to a regime they and the rest of the world regarded as belligerent, that has frequently weaponized belligerents. The underlying intent was for a far more subtle, slower means of transition, a gentle goading toward Chinese-style reform. The plan was more ambitious than its critics give it credit for. President Kim intended for a broad framework of cooperation that would include developing the North's crumbling infrastructure and, through a series of investments, gradually bringing the living standards of average North Koreans up to match the level of their southern compatriots. By slowly but steadily increasing the North's economic dependence on the South, a relatively equitable reunification, it was hoped, would be the eventual outcome. The failure of the Sunshine Policy was political, meaning it was a failure strictly on the level of politics and politicians. When the North executed its first nuclear test in 2006, it had nothing to do with the Sunshine Policy, despite what its critics might affirm. In fact, it was a reaction to the George W. Bush administration's hostile behavior and its refusal to engage diplomatically with the North, its tearing up of agreements that had been made by the previous administration. It was Bush who, in the words of President Kim Dae-jung, reversed the age of warm sunshine back to the age of cold wind. The North's initial rapid and sudden moves toward nuclearization, leaving the Non-Proliferation Treaty, kicking out inspectors from the International Atomic Energy Agency, testing long-range missiles, were all done with a clear goal in mind, that of gaining a bargaining chip with Washington. The subsequent administration's failures fill in the rationale of the meantime. The Kim family has eyes. They have watched the downfall of Hussein and Gaddafi. That gives them a pretty good idea of what would happen if they gave in to the U.S.'s desire to denuclearize. Now, it is clear to everyone that they never will. If anything, the events of recent years make the North appear stronger than ever before. No wonder they display their missiles everywhere. This is where a refusal to engage has gotten us. In this version of the fable, the wind has won. Dinner's at 8, and so around that time we pull into a broad parking lot surrounded by brand new buildings. Empty restaurants, empty convenience stores, empty supermarkets, empty duty-free. It could be any small mountainside town anywhere the day after the apocalypse. "So, where do we go?" Alec asks as we step out of the van. "Which one of these is our restaurant?"
"That one,"
Min points to the windowless rectangle before us. There's no sign denoting that it's a restaurant. Somehow, she just knows. "All right then. Chow time." The smiling young waitresses lead the sole diners to our table and immediately commence pouring drinks. The opening bars to Pangap Sumnida swell out of some hidden speakers, and three waitresses with wireless mics fall into step and serenade us with the foreigner's welcome song. The mood quickly turns festive, and the waitresses encourage our debauchery, bringing us tambourines and funny little hats to put on each other and take photos. Eventually, the room becomes a little less empty with the arrival of an extended family from Pyongyang, who occupy a large table on the side of the open floor that has become our makeshift stage. They stare at us shyly as we take our turns at karaoke, but don't take up any of our invitations to mingle. I don't know the words to that many songs, especially compared to Alec and Alexander. Instead, one waitress keeps bringing me the tambourine and pushing me toward the stage. By now, I've ingested enough liquid confidence to propel me through this, So with a crown of lilies on my head, I hop over next to Alec and begin banging the tambourine furiously in rhythm to the moranbong number he's warbling through. My banging adds a pulse to the music I had always detected automatically, but that most Koreans, it seems, hadn't. I sit back down, but each time I do, either Ro or Min or Kim or one of the waitresses places the tambourine back in my hands and pushes me up, and I start to rock out again, to their obvious amusement. In a country where spontaneity and looseness are unheard of, the idea of dancing freely, of making it up as you go along, of losing yourself, of submitting to the rhythms of the music, is a novelty. Nobody goes so far as to join us and dance, but everyone watches, transfixed. Except for Alexander, who is busy laughing his ass off. Finally, it's my turn to sing. In Wonsan, Min had written down the words to Arirang, the beloved folk song of reunification. "It's your final assignment," she told me. "You have to do it at karaoke." I'm helped along by one of the waitresses, but surprisingly managed to make my way to the end. At least I am now able to read the words on the screen, thanks to Ms. Park. Comrade Kim claps his hands. "Amazing," he says. "A month ago, he couldn't understand anything." "And I still don't," I say. "But at least I can mouth the words." He smiles. "That's enough to get by." Chapter 46. Our drive back to Pyongyang the next morning takes us past rolling fields dotted with toiling farmers, decrepit villages, puttering wood-burning trucks spewing smoke and filled with tired, sunburnt day laborers. It's already near dark by the time we reach the checkpoint marking the entrance to the capital. Min hops out with all the permits and paperwork, hands them to the young soldier, who salutes our vehicle. They always give the guides a rough time when re-entering the city, and this time isn't any different. The soldier spits and cooks up some bullshit excuse to chew Min out, something about how vehicles transporting foreigners are supposed to drive in a special lane, even though the highway is completely empty, as it has been all day, all week, all year. Ro hops out of the car to assist Min. Good. Now the soldier has two people he can insult instead of just one. The main point, of course, is to remind these lowly citizens just how much of a privilege and honor it is to live in the capital. That they never forget it, never once take it for granted. A black Mercedes with tinted windows speeds toward the checkpoint. The soldier turns around, salutes the vehicle as it flies past. One of those cars with a 727 license plate. Someone returning from official Workers' Party business. Clearly in too much of a hurry to stop and say hello. Finally, the soldiers wave us on. Stopped at an intersection, we watch an argument between an old woman pushing a heavy cart and an older man. The old woman loses her temper, lunges forward, and begins pummeling the old man in the chest, nearly knocking him over, shouting obscenities all the while. The bored traffic girl stands on the street corner behind, watching them. Finally, she blows her whistle, steps forward into her position in traffic. The old woman and man separate, cross the street in opposite directions. Our van moves past the scene. Up ahead, a golden sunset over the high-rises. We have our final dinner, where we had our first dinner, in a private room at the restaurant in the basement of the Kwangbok Street Shopping Center. Everybody's in a happy mood, though there's also a hint of melancholy. Nobody knows when or if we'll see each other again, especially we students and the North Koreans. "May I ask you something, Travis?" Comrade Kim asks after we finish eating. "I don't know if you even want to answer this or not. If not, it's okay." My stomach tightens. "No, go ahead," I tell him.
"Are Americans even allowed by your government to travel to our country?"
I laugh wearily. I've never been so tired of being an American in all my life.
Yes, of course we are. We can travel anywhere we want. Except for Cuba. Though, don't tell anyone. I've been there too. So there is no risk of you getting into trouble by coming here?
No, I said. There's not.
Not at this point in time, at least.
Comrade Kim chews on his toothpick, thoughtfully.
Of course, I say. I don't know what will happen, what with the, warm beer case and everything.
Warm beer, Kim laughs. Yes, you were very brave for coming here.
I laugh too. I never felt at risk, I tell him, somewhat truthfully. I mean, warm beer brought this on himself, clearly. If you try to steal something like that, of course you are going to get arrested.
Well, says Kim, with a sharp edge to his voice. I don't know what happened with Warmbier, but you, Travis, I can assure you.
He shakes his finger at me warm-naturedly.
You will always be safe when you travel here with us. That I can personally guarantee you.
He smiles.
But what about the letter? Alexander interrupts.
Letter?
The letter of recommendation. I asked you to get me from the school.
Is it still possible?
Alexander has some fantasy that securing a letter of recommendation from the university will aid him in his quest to apply for a longer, more official course of study at Kim Il-sung University next year. He has asked several times, but the Koreans clearly have no idea what he's talking about. It's not like this is a normal country, where one fills out an application form and submits letters of recommendation when applying for admission to a university. For everything he knows, Alexander still doesn't get that that's not how things work here. That there is, in fact, no standard procedure for a foreigner in applying to study at any university. There is no precedent. And he should know, since we're among the first to have ever done it.
The certificate you got today, Comrade Kim calmly picks his teeth. That should be sufficient.
Okay, what about the phone number?
What phone number?
For the university.
There is no phone number.
The university doesn't have a phone?
It is internal. It is impossible to call from a foreign number.
But what if I want to come here again to study?
Comrade Kim shoots him a calculatedly pensive look.
It is best if you come again with Tongil tours, he replies coolly.
Alexander can't let it go. We're leaving tomorrow, and he can't handle it.
Yes, but this is only for 1 month, and it's on a tourist visa, not a student visa. What if I want to come back and study for a longer period? How do I get the visa? Who do I talk to? Can you give me the number of someone in the Ministry of Education? Maybe your guy in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs?
It is not so easy, I'm afraid.
Well, then what can I do?
Kim eyes Alec with a sly smile. 2019, he says. I think 2019 will be a very good year.
But what if I want to come back before?
Witnessing this conversation is almost unbearably awkward. Kim doing things the non-committal Norco way, all understatement and whispered inference, Alexander with this disturbing eruption of pushiness that defies all subtlety.
2019, Kim repeats. 2019.
What everyone knows, but can't say aloud, is that Alec has been awarded a scholarship to study at a university in Seoul for the next 3 years. But as it is subsidized by the Australian and South Korean governments, one of the stipulations is that he is not allowed to enter the North for the duration of his study. 2019 is the year it finishes, the year he'll be able to return.
I understand what you mean, says Alexander tensely. But what if I want to come back before then?
Kim removes the toothpick from his mouth.
I don't know that I understand what you mean.
Tell me something.
Why do you want so badly to study here in Korea?
Because I want to learn the language.
Then why don't you go to study in the South? It would be much easier for you to arrange.
I'm not interested in the South. I am interested in this country.
That's what I can't understand. Why are you so interested in my country? What is it exactly that you want to do here? I don't understand what your business is. I can understand Alec, for instance. He is running a company specializing in tours. Okay, I get it. But you, I still don't understand what it is you are doing. What it is you want. Why do you even want to learn Korean?
I don't know for sure.
I'm still figuring out what I want to do. I'm just a student for now. Kim stares at him suspiciously. What kind of answer is that? His eyes seem to say. And your father is okay with this? Just studying for no reason until you find what it is you want to do?
Yes. My parents are fine with it. I mean, wasn't it the same for you at my age?
No.
So you knew exactly what it was you wanted to do with your life?
Yes.
What?
To serve the motherland.
Kim nods, satisfied at having given the correct answer. That answer should have put an end to everything. Certificates, medals, rank, all insignia of a world we don't belong to, that we never will. It is a conversation we've had before, and not one that needs to be had again, and certainly not with those forced to endure its consequences. This should be readily comprehensible and easy by now to accept. Instead, it only rankles Alexander further. He is, I realize, experiencing something we all do upon leaving this place. That knife-sharp cognizance of not belonging. Not just of not belonging, but of our tremendous failure to ever understand. Alexander is free-falling into the same trap that every would-be Pyongyangologist who comes here and becomes obsessed with the place falls into. The question of access. Of which doors we are allowed to open, which are locked for us, and why. Behind those locked doors, so the assumption goes, is where the truth must hide.
I will never come back here as a tourist, Alexander sneers.
As though it is one's tourist status that prevents one from unlocking that door. As though having a different visa status, which gives one a minder instead of a guide, will somehow alter your perception of everything that lies before you. Coming here under some other visa category, whether as a diplomat or NGO worker, does not give you more access. You are still not allowed to enter any North Korean's home. You are still forced to have two North Koreans accompany you in most contexts. So, what exactly is he trying to achieve? The truth, however, is in actuality so banal that it usually eludes us. The truth is that neither Alexander, nor Alec, nor I will ever be regarded as one of them. The system is what it is. It predates us, and it will likely endure in some form or other until well after we are gone. The truth is being disclosed unwittingly to Alexander in the very conversation he is now having with Comrade Kim, in this drama between the irreconcilable worlds of the liberal arts model of finding yourself via education versus the self predefined as a vessel of the state. The truth is, in short, right in front of us, everywhere we look, lucent as the light that burrows its holes into the morning fog until it dissipates in the clarity of day. The only thing missing is the stories of the faces we see around us. Stories, indeed, that yearn to be told, but cannot be for now. And we have to leave it at that, because in the end, they are not our stories to tell. Chapter 47. After dinner, we head to the Taedong River Beer Festival. It's the first year they're holding it, on the banks off the square right across from the lit-up Jucha Tower, the same banks where we ditched our guides and took our risky walk that afternoon. Arriving past the barricades, Min presents us each with three tickets redeemable for our choice of light or dark drafts of the local Taedong Gang brew. Foreign tour groups intermingle with a crowd of Pyongyangites, and nobody tries to separate them. The mood convivial. Uncontrived. Relaxed. It's certainly the most normal social gathering I've ever attended here, and it fills me with hope for the future. Walking among the laughing, beer-swilling groups, I spot one table with 3 20-something guys I'm absolutely certain are gay. Neatly dressed, with fashionable South Korean-style haircuts, they giggle as they show each other photos on their smartphones. I'm tempted to pull up a chair, join them, but then I think better of the idea. Ro claps me on the back. "How are you, Comrade Travis?" "Comrade Ro, I'm fine, thanks. Are you having fun?" "No," he smiles. "Really? Why not?" "I will have fun tomorrow," he says, "when I can come here with my wife and daughter." Well then, at least we know someone isn't going to be missing us. Later, we drop Comrade Kim off in front of a newish apartment block in East Pyongyang. Definitely not the poor area by our school. Electricity abounds, everything is lit up. A low-rise, only 5 floors, a huge benefit given the power outages that often leave the elevator dependent stranded. At least, I think it's his building. As we pull away, I look behind and notice Kim standing there, watching our car disappear into traffic. I want to believe he is sad to see us go, but perhaps he just wants to be sure we don't see which house he is about to disappear into. To be truthful, I don't really know who Comrade Kim is, or what goes on in his head when he closes the door to his apartment behind him and retires for the night. All I can do is employ that sharpened tool relied upon by every aspiring Pyongyangologist. Speculation. To me, Comrade Kim is a Pyongyang man of the moment, an idol of the Kim Jong-un era, a cynic, an optimist, and a gambler, all rolled into one. He hates the system because he spent enough time outside to see it for what it is, but he also knows how to work it, and anyway, believes it will all probably crumble in a few years. And if it takes too long to do so, then perhaps in the back of his mind, he has a plan to get out once his father passes away. In the meantime, the goal is to get as rich as possible. He turns the bedside lamp off as he crawls into bed next to his wife. He has to wake up early tomorrow to see us off at the airport. And after that, another business trip, this time to Nampo on the West Coast. He's building a factory there. But as to what will be made in that factory, well, as with most things these days, it's complicated. No, I don't know much about Comrade Kim. But I somehow feel I will see him again someday. In Pyongyang, or elsewhere. Chapter 48. And so, we depart the land of morning calm. Min is waiting for us in the lobby, to assist with the checkout procedure. She hands us each our passports, sniffling. Hua has already pulled the van up to the entrance. Ro is inside, waiting. We make our final bows to the bellhop, and then climb into the van for one last ride through the city. Today is not so misty. In fact, the sun has risen quite early, casting a startling clarity upon all the familiar scenes we drive past. We hit a red light right in front of the Ryugyong Hotel, that majestic, never-to-be-finished relic. It is Pyongyang's Eiffel Tower, it now occurs to me. Just as that epochal structure, which can be seen everywhere one looks throughout the city, stood for something more than itself in the Paris of the 19th century when it was erected, so the Ryugyong, in its perpetual state of incompletion, is an icon of the larger incompletion of Korea as a nation. It stands tall and proud in its brute bluntness. But its shimmering facade is all there is. Its glass windows reflect the city back onto itself, concealing whatever lies within. A temple that can only be pondered from without. Wah turns on the radio. The opening bars to a Moranbong band song, Voice of My Heart. Another peon to patriotism, sure, but this one gently moving in its sweet simplicity, its melody a lullaby. Min softly sings along. The deepest thoughts of my heart, I tell my mother, all truthful, hiding nothing, and my mind gets relieved. Because you are a caring mother, with warm and deep compassion, my wounded sore heart was healed by your warm affection. If there had been no love, I would have gotten sores as from a whip. But although I was a foolish child, mother raised me lovingly. Without fear or hesitation, I was embraced in her bosom. I was not afraid to tell my faults and mistakes, all truthfully and openly. As we coast through the streets, I study the faces of all the people we pass by. People on their way to work, to school. I wonder about their lives, all those stories yet to be told. All the ones I see, but also the ones who are absent. The ones who were born into this city, this society, and have been able to thrive. But also the ones who have failed to adapt. The poor ones who grew up to become rich. The rich ones who grew richer and then, one day, lost it all and fled. The ones who still struggle to understand the world around them, their place in it. The ones who said the wrong thing, got into trouble. The ones who said the right thing, got into trouble anyway. The ones who got sent away and were called for again, only to be sent back. The ones who were sent away and never seen or heard from thereafter. The ones who devoted their entire lives to the cause, only to watch it implode before them, their efforts wasted, taking them and everyone they truly loved down with it. The ones who never really believed in any of it to begin with, but were still richly rewarded. The ones who stood by while others suffered, using the grand cause as their excuse for inaction. The selfish ones, the selfless ones, the ones who were shattered by the generosity they received and didn't expect, having never believed that their lives were worth all that much. The ones who were raised to believe in something else entirely and died still believing in that thing. The ones who were won over by it all, who thought if they only believed hard enough, dedicated themselves a little more, great things would eventually come their way. The ones I have met and spoken to. The ones I will never know. The ones who still dream. And the ones who can no longer. In this bosom, millions of children have been raised as one single heart. In order to live a shining life, I will follow only my mother. Selflessly and forever. I will love only you, mother, mother, oh great mother, I will forever remain in your arms. Epilogue. History continues to write itself at a frenetic pace. Although less than 2 years have passed since that summer of 2016, much has happened in the intervening period. Otto Warmbier was released by the DPRK authorities, flown back to the United States in a comatose state, and died shortly thereafter. A newly elected U.S. president, who appears to have only the vaguest understanding of the tense political malaise that has afflicted East Asia for more than half a century, issues flippant threats of nuclear war. Punishing sanctions continue to cripple the North's moribund economy, which will only force the people of North Korea to find new, undoubtedly illegal, means of generating hard currency. The U.S. has elected to slam shut the final door on engagement by banning its citizens from visiting as tourists, threatening those who choose to violate the statute with the draconian confiscation of their passport, which means effectively taking away one's right as a U.S. citizen to freedom of movement, a right that ironically is denied to the people of the DPRK by their government, a form of punishment that has no precedent and is probably illegal. Much has happened, and even more will happen before this book goes to print. So much, in fact, that I find it somewhat pointless to comment on any one of these issues, since given the volatile nature of the conflict, any of them could be sidelined or eradicated by tomorrow's events. Suffice to say that the threat of war is very real, and its implications must be fully understood, because ultimately, it would have a dire effect on virtually all of us. Were a new Korean War to erupt, hundreds of thousands, if not millions, would die. The battle would not be confined to the Korean Peninsula. China, which does not wish to have American soldiers at its border, would inevitably be forced to side with North Korea, and the result would effectively be a proxy war between China and the United States. Given Russia's recent warming of ties with North Korea and its own shared border with the country, there is a chance that it would also become involved. All conflicts that have long been festering in this troubled region would erupt. China would be impelled to make a grab for Taiwan, sparking yet another bloody confrontation. With South Korea, the world's 11th largest economy, under nuclear siege, the global economy would likely collapse. In short, this would not be a regional war. It would be World War III. In such a conflict, there would be no winners, only losers. We have to ask ourselves, as citizens of the world, regardless of nationality, whether such a battle is truly worthwhile. In the summer of 2017, Tongil Tours held its second Pyongyang Summer Language Program. This time, 10 students signed up. None of us originators were able to attend. Alec wanted to go but was still on his scholarship in Seoul. But I've heard it was a roaring success. It was not without its challenges, however. The biggest one was posed by one of Tongil Tour's competitors, Jucha Travel Services, which began to offer the exact same study program at the same university. Even worse, JTS's publicity for the tour was filled with erroneous claims that the students would take classes at Kim Il-sung University, the country's most prestigious, rather than Kim Hyong-jik. That students would be able to stay on campus in the dormitories alongside North Korean students. That this program was the first of its kind. All claims that turned out to be false. It seems that the cowboy capitalism that predominates in Pyongyang, which is but a pale reflection of our own neoliberal economic system, has also infected the bear market economy of DPRK tourism. Nonetheless, Tongil Tours soldiers on. Because of all the new Westerners in her charge, I've heard that Ms. Park has now been required to take English classes and is well on her way toward fluency. Alec got back together with his girlfriend. Actually, she had been receiving his text messages all along, but for whatever reason, her responses to those messages were not being transmitted. As I was finishing this book, I received an invitation to their wedding this spring. Sadly, I will not be able to attend, as the ceremony is to take place. Where else? In Pyongyang. Alexander continues to plot his return to North Korea. His latest scheme is to pursue a doctorate in DPRK law at Kim Il-sung University. Problem is, his Korean is still not good enough. When he heard that a representative from Kim Il-sung University was going to be in Beijing, where he has spent the past year studying, he asked Alec, with his superior Korean, to imitate him over the phone in the hopes that he would win admittance. I'm not sure how it will pan out, but it wouldn't surprise me if Alexander wound up working for the French Cooperation Bureau in Pyongyang someday, and eventually writing a book on his own experiences. Writing this book has effectively prolonged my stay in Pyongyang. Each day, I relive the events, the people, the places I experienced on my trips to the country over the past 5 years. At night, I frequently dream that I'm back there, walking the streets, the violins and synths of a Moranbong Band pop tune faintly discernible in the background. There's one memory in particular that I prefer to revisit. It's from 2012, my first trip to the country. We are at the demilitarized zone on the border with the South, about to be given a tour of the historical stalemate that has solidified the division of this peninsula for the past 59 years. The soldier giving us the tour is a young guy, around the same age as me. We look at each other and smile. Something clicks. His job is to stand across the dividing line and stare down the enemy each day. But I'm the first American he's ever actually spoken to. We are led from the gift shop into a small lecture room. With a wooden pointer, the soldier briefly explains the engraved wall map of the surrounding area. He leads us outside, where we are made to walk single file through an entrance gate. On the other side, our bus is waiting for us. We climb in along with the officer. We drive along a dirt road surrounded by weeds, in which no doubt a number of mines have been embedded. Past all the moats, the block obstacles, the drop-down barriers that imply that demilitarized zone is something of a misnomer. We arrive at the Armistice Talks Hall, a modest hut fronted with a small steel. Next door is a large, single-story building with a dove on the roof. This is where the Armistice Agreement was ultimately signed on July 27, 1953. In the center of the room, the chairs, tables, and flags that were there that day have been faithfully preserved. Surrounding this display, a museum has been erected on the walls, with blown-up photographs of Kim Il-sung and all the expected evidential images of war and torment and U.S. aggression, and the ultimate triumph of the Korean People's Army. We are guided to the Joint Security Area. Here, I lay eyes on South Korea for the first time. Across the dividing line, a row of blue and white huts. This is where the armistice talks are held, have been held ever since the war ground to its standstill. We stand on the platform of the Stalinist-style building overlooking the scene. Across from us, the South's equivalent is a high-tech mammoth that fuses edgy postmodern aesthetics with traditional Korean style. But the South Korean side is completely vacant, devoid of soldiers and tourists, while on our side, there is just our small group and a couple of soldiers who have been placed before the main dividing line, as though to prevent any of us from crossing over. We go inside the central hut. This is the Military Armistice Commission Conference Hall. We are invited to sit at the large round table in the center of the room, which is lined with live microphones. Here, whenever North and South must hold official talks, is where it's done. Two more North Korean soldiers stand inside the hut, blocking the exit on the South Korean side. On the walls, a display of flags of each of the countries that participated in the Korean War against the DPRK. We take our photos, and after finishing his narration in somber voice and answering all our questions, the soldier leads us back to our van. We climb in and begin our drive back to Panmunjom, the name of the truce village, which no longer actually exists. Now, it is little more than a name for this place where a divided land attempts to acknowledge its past and move toward an ever-uncertain future. The melancholic mood lifts instantly as the soldier climbs into the back of the van and plants himself next to me. He's handsome, with unblemished, untanned complexion, and looks well-fed, no doubt from a well-to-do and well-connected family, as it takes both money and connections for a soldier this young to get a prestige post like this. A poor soldier from Nowheresville would more likely be assigned to a grueling construction post as his first assignment. Perhaps he has also been chosen for his height. At 6 feet tall, he is a towering antidote to the common perception that the majority of soldiers' growth has been stunted as a consequence of the arduous march. As he speaks to me enthusiastically, he gestures with his hands, rough and swollen from his daily taekwondo training, breaking wooden slabs and concrete bricks with his fists. He's full of questions, who I am, what I do, and our guide laughs delightedly as she translates our exchange. Mostly, he wants to know what I think of his country. Have I been to the South before? I say no, because at the time I hadn't. I ask him where